for us.
Have a place to talk to them and show them movies, and this would take a modification. So one of the first, I didn't use green stripes on recruiting, but one of the first decisions I made was putting a group together, getting bids on the various, from the various RV manufacturers, and there were very few at that time. Well, Winnebago did not submit the winning bid, but an organization called Cortez did. It has since gone out of business, but it was a very fine old group, and they had a quality product, and they submitted exactly what we wanted. And that was something that maintenance would be very easy. It'd be, I think the length was 23 feet, and which meant that it was convenient enough you could park
in the shopping,
a regular shopping center. Had an opening like this on the curb side that you could lower the panel and then have a rear view projector that would show movies that could be seen in by a larger group outside under the awning. It had a very small galley and refrigerator in it for coffee and cokes and so forth. No sofas, but interviewing booths, testing booths, about three booths with a little swing out seats so that they could take the test right there.
And
then a small potty only with holding tanks, small water supply so that you know, they could have coffee and things like that. And on we had quite a discussion. Finally, the design that I selected that had red, white, and blue and a big slant, and then a blue streak down the side, navy blue, and the navy logos, Go Navy, and the navy seal, and on the even the hood front of it, like the ambulances, you know, have ambulance printed backwards. Mm-hmm. One, it attracts attention when people walk by. Go Navy, except
printed
it's backwards. But in
so
your rear view mirror, it reads right. And that came into being. I've got some pictures of that early model that you might like. They were Polaroids, but they kept their color good. Mm-hmm. And when they brought the first one by headquarters to be seen, and all of the staff, they were so interested in coming out and seeing it, you know. And
they got one for each district, didn't they?
Yeah, we got two for each district eventually.
Yeah.
And later, we found use for a smaller, when the RV people came out with a smaller version, then we were able to get those towards the latter part of my 3 years that gave us even wider coverage. It didn't have all the facilities, but it got them around and gave them a chance to do the visuals and be at, you know, track meets and baseball games.
County fairs.
Whole story is how Atlas Van Line supported us in the form of Bill Muncy, who was the world's winningest unlimited hydroplane driver. And very interesting story on that. But that's my story, not recruiting in Admiral Zumwalt's.
Two districts, two per district. How many districts were there?
52.
52.
And of course, that took a period of time. We first won per district, and then we started duplicating because there was such a demand for them to show up at events, craft fairs, and anything where there's a crowd of quality young people who wanted to display them.
Track meets and football games.
To give families information also. Those things, and there was...
But those were innovative things that Bud bought into. You know, great, do it. Of course, none of this could be done without his okaying.
Right, but this is his willingness to listen to something
right.
That was unconventional. That
innovative, exactly.
There's always at the root of these things, how can you do it? Well, it takes money. And there was difficulty in getting money. They had an Assistant Secretary of Defense for manpower and personnel who decided that he had better be responsible for all of the services recruiting efforts. So because he saw that there was competition, and the Army was having very great difficulty because they came out of Vietnam scarred the worst as far as public impression, and it also the result of so many of the veterans having, you know, been in fatigues, and this represented Army image, and, you know, they were throwing their medals over the wall and things like that. So they did have a problem. And I always had to sell the Navy's problem of recruiting as well, because of time away from family, this is not easy to sell. And the Air Force has an excellent ability to promise a person, a recruit, he's going to be at this one base 4 years, he can take night school courses, he's not going to have to go to sea, and he can wind up getting his degree while he's at this one station. The Navy can't do that. Well, we answered that by sending instructors to sea, and we have a pretty good college program on that now. And of course, computer training now has met a large part of that need. But these were the kinds of competitive things going on. And the first assistant SecDef was somewhat oriented to the Navy, difficult to deal with. And there was always the asymmetrical, not symmetrical, allocation of funds. There, you know, the Army got more dollars per recruit quota than the Navy got, and because the Army had the more difficult job to do. And so it wasn't a free ride for us, even though Admiral Zumwalt did everything within his power to support and back us up. A lot of anecdotes, but they're all about me and not necessarily him. But his one simple, I think, an anecdote of interest that again shows his humor. We were making a speech, and he had, was talking to a group of maybe like Navy League people, and he, at a banquet, he had his comments, and he said, "I'd like for Admiral Tidd to address you," and because there were some specific points we wanted to make about the location. He had, you know, said our some very complimentary things, and in the introduction of me, and I got up, and the Secretary of the Navy was there, and I said, I really do appreciate those kind words, and you've been more than generous with them, and I want to know one thing, Mr. Secretary and Admiral Zumwalt, if we fail to make these numbers, are you going to love me as much as you do now?" And he stood up with that big grin and he said, "We're going to love you just as much, Emmett, but we sure are going to miss you." And of course, that brought the house down. And it was just an example of his great humor and ability to come up with something like that. It was, as to the Navy's problems then, the racial problem really brought in a new realm of challenge. And it's covered very well in On Watch, his dialogue with Admiral Clary, and I think is one of the great attributes of Admiral Clary, of acknowledging that what he needed out there was an ADEC that tracked these decisions to assure, and he said, "If we'd have all done that, we wouldn't have these problems." Not giving credit to the NADEC, but giving credit to the fact that Admiral Clary recognized the importance of carrying out the policies that Admiral Zumwalt was trying to get implemented, because the problem were not the directives, but the lack of implementation at the local command level. And Admiral Clary made that point very clear. We had to then start devoting more attention to increasing, because we couldn't go out to quality black gatherings and say, you know, the Navy's great, we've got a good future here, and they say, "What percentage of the Navy's black?" And when we were down to 2%, you couldn't think that there were a lot of people reenlisting in the Navy that were black then. So we had to make conscious efforts at minority recruiting. We brought in good blacks for doing that. He brought in a naval aviator, black aviator, Bill Norman, who was had resigned from the Navy because of as he saw prejudices, and the Admiral brought him in to be a direct advisor to him of minority affairs, and in turn the Admiral was criticized for doing that, thought that was giving too much preference, but it helped sensitize the Admiral, as well as I found out, to my great surprise, that I you know, things that I took for granted as being a normal way of speaking were offensive. You know, you say something, boy, those are great boys, and it's a derogatory term from slave days where the boy was the one that held the horses while the master got out of the carriage. Just any number of things like that, this business of the special cosmetic needs of the blacks and so forth. But we had to address that. We had to educate our recruiters. We had to get good blacks in from the fleet who believed in selling the Navy.
And young Bill Norman, who's close to our age now, not quite, is still part of the many staff that comes every other year and joins us, he and his wife. Great couple.
He, up till recently, was a senior vice president for Amtrak. And I forget, oh, he's now with RVIA, I believe, which is Recreation Vehicle Industry of America, or Institute of America, something like that. Has an association with them. But those were challenges, and we met them as best we could, and we continued to hold quality, and Admiral Zumwalt bought the proposition that we've got to hold equality, and numbers will be second. If we can't make our numbers, then we'll suffer the shortfalls until we can get the quality totals up to where we need.
So he would rather have a smaller number of quality people and not meet the numbers than the alternative?
Right, because the alternative had been demonstrated as a source of a lot of problems. Mm-hmm. And you could do a better job with fewer people rather, and the same applied to draftees, which you had to have too many supervisory personnel per draftee. And this isn't to say that all draftees were bad. We have tremendously fine people that just held out as they would for their family, but they finally got drafted, and that was it. But they were good servants of their country and patriots. But what I am saying, there were far too many that were not motivated sufficiently to do a good job. That, again, is human nature, and we were fortunate, I think. I was fully in favor of an all-volunteer force, having had to serve with people during World War II who were drafted into the Navy, and you would have done better with fewer, with the bunks empty than with them filled. Mm-hmm. And we had this option then at the end of Vietnam, and I think it's the greatest thing that happened towards the stability in the country of getting the riots off the campuses and then making us develop a product that was more sellable, meaning that it had to recognize the changes in the world and in the current generation, and that our old bowls, we can save traditions that have meaning, but we can do away with those that are anachronistic, is the term, not applicable any longer, that young people can't accept.
So recruiting overall is a challenge, and recruiting minorities is even more of a challenge, given the racial problems, given the perception that very few minorities serve in the Navy, and very even of those that do, many of them choose not to remain. After something like ZGRAM 116, what focus then do you have on trying to recruit women?
116 was what, we will have females in the Navy?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was, we will have broader opportunities for women.
Oh, right. The opportunities.
Right. Which might then be a better magnet to bring quality young women into the service.
There was opposition, of course, more from the fleet, because we had the luxury of being able to select all high school graduates from the female. We had more female applicants than we had quotas from the Bureau of Naval Personnel because there were fewer billets available. Navy had this problem. The Navy's made to send ships to sea. Ships go to sea, And they, for combat, and we did not have, at that time, the congressional law was that women shall not be in combat. Well, the majority of our Navy has combat and billets in ships. All ships, well, let me say it this way, all billets in a ship are combatant billets by the nature of the beast. One sinks, they all sink, as far as personnel.
Does this include even transport and support vessels, or?
Well, there were some that finally the argument got around to, you see, even our resupply ships, the logistics ships, they go forward with the fleet to form this unbroken chain of supply, so that if we go off the coast of Vietnam, we've got a train of ships to support them. They're always subject to interdiction by submarine or other attack. Being in company with the combatant forces, they're subject to the same kind of enemy attacks as any of the other ships, and often are softer target and more frequently attacked.
But couldn't the nurses in some ships go to sea?
Yeah, nurses had always been an exception in the hospital ships, but they weren't permitted on aircraft carriers.
No, right.
Right, the nurses were the exception. One of the things that 116 did, it established a pilot program where women could serve in the actual crew of a hospital ship, like you mentioned, in this case, the Sanctuary, and that was the pilot program.
Right.
And we're going to, I guess, experiment with this and see how it works.
From that grew then the fact, and then we got into yard tugs and things like that. And then, because you had to get them into the ships, otherwise you wouldn't have rotation for the men in the fleet pretty soon, with the large number of females filling all of the kinds of shore billets that they could fill, then where would the people from the fleet go? And we weren't permitted these excess billets. And we were already having some people having served 12 years at sea before they got a shot at shore duty, boiler tenders and some like that in critical ratings. They were doing a tough, dirty job, and yet they never got their shot at shore duty with the family. And so it created a problem and could only be solved if you were going to have women in the Navy in significant numbers. You had to create billets at sea for them. And the Navy, fortunately, I think, Les, started out, as you mentioned, with pilot programs on a small scale so that we could develop a cadre of women who had experience and who were mature, both enlisted and officer. And then we started bringing in more in each of those ships so that they could absorb them and they would be supervised and properly counseled. We then started putting them in ships that didn't go at sea as much, such as the repair ships. They started using them in yard craft, in the tugs.
On the signal bridge? The signalman?
Oh, that's a good example. We started civilianizing civil service crews in the logistics support ships. This was several years later, not during my watch.
No.
Similar to what the British do.
MSTS or?
Right. But on each of those ships that followed the fleet, where normally we would have our Navy logistics ships, these then had put the stripes around the stack, and they were the same old ships, but with civilian crewmen. But there was always a cadre for security of cryptanalysis and radio traffic and signaling that were retained on board. Some 10 years ago, I guess now, I went out on a ship that my son Kurt, a Spruance class, that he was operations officer on, USS Dale, and we had an evening sunset refueling with an ammunition, with an oiler. And on the bridge was a signal gang, talking to the signal gang, as they always do alongside with semaphore, and after the fueling has started, chit-chatting by semaphore. All four of the signalmen on the tanker were females, and they were just as capable and fast as the signalman on the destroyer. And one of the first-class signalmen was laughing a lot after he had, you know, he'd look at, read visually the semaphore signal, which I couldn't read. Then he'd just laugh, and I said, "What's so funny?" And he said, "Oh, she used to be my wife." He said, "But she's a damn good signalman." But that was just an example, you know, of the evolution they've gone through, and now they're going into the ships. I don't know what percent Kurt now has on his ship that he has command of, but it has progressed, and you've heard us, and I talked about the Laboon, which is an Aegis class that fired the missiles most recently into Iraq, some 14, I think it was, or 28. Anyhow, into specified command and control, air control centers.
With a no-fly
with
thing.
Right. Great accuracy, and the weapons officer on board that actually pushed the button was a female lieutenant who, the CBS interviews, who's not known to be charitable towards the military, was very, the crew that they interviewed were very flattering of the comments that this is an individual that's an officer in every sense of the word. She's a professional, she knows her job, she does it well, and we're proud to serve under even the old Master Chief Petty Officer of the ship. Just couldn't have said better things than you could have hoped for in a recruiting film. And that was historic because that's the first known instance of a female firing a hostile guided missile, mm-hmm. in this case the Tomahawk. So it's progressing. I hope it continues to go well. The problems are not nearly as great as advertised. There was a big splash in the news about one of the tenders that came back from the Gulf after Desert Storm as to the high pregnancy rate. And after much analysis and studies by outsiders, the rate was no higher than to be expected among the civilian population. In fact, it was lower.
At that age.
And because many of these were pregnancies that conception had developed before the ship deployed. And so naturally the ladies had to come ashore for their delivery. But that's going to be one of the problems we face, but it's not insurmountable. Mm-hmm. As the commanding officer's ship, it's a problem I would not like to accept if I had a choice. There are enough command problems, and but it's the law, and it's going to be carried out.
Did that color review at all at the time when the Z-grams went out, and now you're in a position of responsibility for recruiting? Do you, were you fully behind the racial and gender initiatives that the Admiral had, or did you maybe think?
No, I was absolutely behind them. The law had not been changed at that time, but you could see that it was going to inevitably change, and it would have to. I was behind it because I fully believed in it. I had never had any problems with a racial problem. And
you started out with that in Buford's as a lieutenant.
Well, yeah, I had, when I was, and again, I hate to get on this because it's me, but when I was brought in from a ship that I had served a tour in Korea and was about to go back to Korea, and I got Shanghai to Washington for the first time and put in charge of a section that had 100 females working for me, and about 90 of them were black. Did a good job, responded well to positive leadership, and so I'd just grown up in a milieu that I had some of my best workers had already always been blacks, and had no problem. But the law had not yet been passed, but we did have this problem of seashore rotating looming, and you had to some way convince our sailors that, look, we got to work around that problem, and it's going to be done.
I'm just curious about that simply because a lot of the people who opposed that were characterized, or at least in some of the things I've read, is not only they are opposed to changes in the Navy, but some of them are also Southerners.
Absolutely. You know, like, absolutely.
And this isn't just naval officers, this is also congressmen.
Absolutely.
Who, you know, sparked the investigation of the racial incidents on the ships, and who mm-hmm. accused Admiral Zumwalt of permissiveness. Mm-hmm. And you being from Texas, I mean, growing up in that period of time, yeah. I mean, that you might have a view on that.
it was a problem, and that's what the reason why Admiral Zumwalt had to step in and say, we are going to become sensitive to the issues, and we need the quality people that are out there. And it was the command that refused to acknowledge they had a problem and wouldn't carry out his policies, then that was the command in which the problems erupted, the significant problems. And
we did not go to school in a desegregated school as youngsters growing up. That was before Brown versus Yvonne. And so we had not had that kind of experience, but from the time he was a lieutenant, then there was no more color.
Right.
You know.
Because the Navy by that point, or the military,
right after Truman put out the edict.
Right.
I didn't have any problem with that.
I mean, your best supporters were the young men that were in that department.
Oh, that's certainly true.
I guess even as late as the 70s, there were some...
Well, sure.
...who still...
You've still got some rednecks around,
right?
Aren't
you? Oh, yes, even now.
Right.
Sure, and you would think, and I like to think that all of my generation had learned the lessons, particularly that had been in the military and exposed to the sensitizing sessions as well as common sense, would have gotten over those. But just recently, a four-star in making a comment that was absolutely racial, if ever I heard him. He'd been retired 30 years, but he was still...
I think I heard about that.
Well, that's not the one in that was a kind
that
of
was one that was on
sexual
that
off-color statement that he made, Sink Pack.
Right, and was immediately retired. No, this is a family friend that's been retired.
Well, this one is not a family friend that I was thinking of, but you still hear that, and we're going to, because...
Until that generation
is gone. It's going to be a long, long time before, you wouldn't hear the president talking so much about now. You know, we've got to come to grips with the racial issue.
Exactly.
It's not an easy thing, but I think the military is way ahead.
It always has been.
The corporate organization and anything else, and it would not have happened. And there's a wonderful tribute that Admiral Zumwalt paid by SecNet John Lehman in his book about this, of how he admired what Bud Zumwalt did in coping with that problem and set the pattern for it. And I think he did. He led the way. And a leader that gets out in front, every once in a while gets some arrows in his back, you know. And that happens.
Gets shot at.
Sure, that's,
but he has the courage.
You about through listening for the day?
Are you all right? You ready to call?
No, I just
don't
impose on you too much.
Oh, no, sir. I'm imposing on me.
You got some more questions? But that's part of Navy life. And if that is his chosen field, that's fine with me. I'll do everything I possibly can to back him up, to fill in the gaps wherever I can. My job was taking care of the home front. Now, I never did work outside the home. There was always enough to do at home and to get ready for the things there. He had a period of time when we were together a lot that when he was ashore, you know, but there was wife's things to do. I like people, and I'm with people, and pretty soon my landlady is my friend, and we're going to the mall together, and we're, you know, it's, I guess everybody's personality is different, and you accept things in a different way. But I never enjoyed saying goodbye. I would take him to the ship the morning that they were deploying, just as any other morning, and then leave. He never saw me cry when the ship left. He didn't have to see me standing over on the pier, waving at the last minute, you know. Mm-hmm. But boy, I was the first one on that pier when the ship came back. Mm-hmm. And the first two ships he was aboard, he was not in command, but from then on he was. And as the commanding officer's wife, I got to go aboard first. And I liked that.
Well, from your perspective, this is, you know, you can accept that because you agreed to marry someone you know is going to be doing this, and that you're going to, you know, you're going to hold up the home front, and you're going to bear up because this is what he's chosen to do, and you've chosen to be there with him. Do you think that, in terms of morale for the men themselves, how do you think that they feel about being away from their wives, and how do they deal with it from your perspective? How did you notice?
Some of them dealt with it very well, some of them didn't. Mm-hmm. I was a Southern lady that, you know, grew up in the South. Your number one priority was your husband. Mm-hmm. Now, he had 5 years of inactive duty from the time he got out of after World War II. We went back to the University of Oklahoma. He got his degree. We went back to Tyler, Texas, started our own business. But then when Korea developed, he was recalled. Mm-hmm. And we picked up and, you know, went on then. Mm-hmm. But we didn't know that he was going to be recalled to the Navy. We didn't know Korea was going to, you know. Mm-hmm. But then after he was recalled and went to Korea and came back and was in Bucharest, and neither one of us knew what Bucharest stood for, the opportunity came up to where he could transfer to USN. He was USNR from, you know, Naval Reserve Officers Training Corps, mm-hmm. which is the way he was commissioned. And this was in 52, I guess, the opportunity came up for lieutenants to transfer to regular Navy. Well, he thought, I'll put in the papers, do we like this? Yes, we enjoyed it. We've made wonderful friends, and if he's selected, fine. If not, we'll do something else. Mm-hmm. But there were an awful lot of people that put in their papers for that, in the hundreds. They could only select 11.
11 out of the entire?
Out of the entire group that had put in their papers for transfer to regular Navy. He had 5 years of inactive duty on his record. Mm-hmm. You'd think, no way could that work out. He was the number one person selected. Now, the reason I know that is I later learned from one of the people who was on the board to select them, told me mm-hmm. that he was the number one selected out of that. And then there were 10 more. But he felt like if he could stand up under that kind of a competition, maybe he could have a career in the Navy. And so he then carried it out, was transferred to regular Navy, and we've never looked back except in joy. It was not fun seeing him going off to Vietnam. The boys and I, we were in charge. He had a ship then for a short period of time, and, you know, Bud wanted him to get there quickly, and the boys and I went back to our house in Arlington. It had been rented, and as with most people in that area that own a house, they have military clause, and if they rent it to a military person, they have double military clauses in the leases, you know. So we could go back home, and my mother was living with us at the time, and we just managed to stay busy. I always tried to lay out enough projects that would keep me busy while he was gone. And the big project during that period was when we were in Charleston, we had joined a wonderful church and become very close to the minister and his wife, and they were building a new church, and they wanted, on the communion rail, they wanted some cushions, needlepoint cushions. And I said, okay, if you will get them donated, I'll see that they're done. And they were individual pillows, and I took them all back to Washington, to Arlington with me, and got friends who did needlepoint. We all did those cushions for the year that Emmett was gone, and then I needlepointed them together so it would be a long piece. Well, there was 20-some-odd of the little individual ones, so it kept me busy all year. And it was, you know, you don't have time to think about other things. That was his job. And that was fine with me, if that's what made him happy. And that's kind of the old traditional Southern girl's way she was reared.
Right.
That you were happy with what you chose in life. And I always was. We've had I guess it's pretty obvious that we loved each other greatly and had a happy life.
Do you think that you're unusual in that respect, simply because Admiral Zumwalt recognized this as enough of a problem that he pushed a plan to home port ships overseas?
Right. Well, I didn't think I was unusual at the time. I realize now that maybe I was. I wasn't aware of it at the time at all. But sort of included me in the things that he could when they would have things out at the observatory. We were generally, if it was a big thing, we were generally included. And as I think I told you the other day, I wanted Musa to feel free at the last minute if she was having a table of 12 for lunch, and if somebody had to drop out at the last minute, rather than there being an empty chair, she could call me 2 hours ahead and say, "Mugs, come, I need you." And I did, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I was happy to do it. That was one way I could help her, and one way I could help Emmett.
Do you think she felt isolated because of who she was, or who she was married to, the position she was in?
No, I don't think she felt isolated at all, but there were a lot of things along with the job that was her job. There was an awful lot of entertaining that was just part of the job. Mm-hmm. It is as an admiral's wife. It was for us in San Diego. We never had small dinner parties. It was usually about 40, and marvelous, wonderful health, and I don't know why, but at our house, we never were able to just sit around tables. We'd pull up a zabuton and sit on the floor, and it was a buffet, and very informal. I'm an informal person, you know, and
I guess as an admiral's wife, or even as a captain's wife, you have to do a lot of open houses for the other officers' wives and families.
Right. One morning, just before they were coming home in the America with his staff, I had a brunch one Sunday. It was the Sunday before Christmas. Christmas tree fell over about an hour before they would get there.
She had a cat?
No, damn cats didn't have anything to do with that. It was one that went to the ceiling, so it was pretty busy around our house for that morning, trying to get it undecorated, laying on the floor, run out and get another one, stand it up, not quite so tall, redecorate it. But, you know, it's
disaster to keep your life interesting.
Exactly. We had a party in San Diego, brunch, and some from one of the ships,
the
that was the Atlantic.
NATO Standing Force.
Was
the NATO naval standing force, there was a ship selected, one destroyer.
But were they in the Pacific?
No, that's in Atlantic.
Right, but anyway, they were, there was a group of British ships.
Oh, the one in the Pacific for San Diego was their fleet that was making a...
Transiting back, yeah. And three people from the wardroom came and said, the bus will be here in a little while with the rest of the wardroom. Now, this was one of their big auxiliary ships. The rest of the wardroom had not been invited. And...
This was just for the CO and XO service of the ships that about four of them were in.
Right. And I could just, I had everything all planned for maybe 25 or 30 people, and I could see about 50 arriving. So it was kind of busy around there for a little while. Mm-hmm. They didn't. They had gotten the word. This particular group had not been aboard ship all night long. But there are a lot of little things that come up, but you do what you can, mm-hmm. you know. But it's fun. I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. But I just wanted to be available to Musa, help her however we could.
Well, I guess you were constrained in this simply because, again, of the perception that you don't want to be seen as being too close to the throne, both for her sake and for yours.
Right. I don't... We've been around an awful lot of people that means a whole lot to. And if they're good friends, wonderful, but I don't want to impose.
Mm-hmm. Our main focus was not imposing. Be too close and persistent when you want a little air space. We've always tried to not impose. I've tried to be a watchdog and give even in retirement life of giving the animal a heads up of some views that I've picked up or something that I think that he might get queried on. And, he's always appreciated it, and a couple of things that we don't impose and generate instances to be together. Mm-hmm. We always hope that they accept that the proper way. We treasure moments with them.
Oh, sure.
Literally treasure
great fun.
Moments with them.
Great fun.
Just such an inspiration.
And he's always so sweet to want us to come early down to Pinehurst and for him to bring his toolbox. We've done little repairs. Emmett can do anything with his hands. He had a door. Now this is an old southern house that has the doors that, in addition to a solid door, there's another door that has the slats in it. Well, the grandchildren had broken one of the slats, and it happened to be the room that one of the ladies was going to be in, and there was that hole you could look through, unless she closed the door, which would have made it hot and uncomfortable. So we got a board and dressed it down to be the right size, and we got some stain, put it in. You can never tell that mm-hmm. one had been broken. He put up new window shades for Musa. He paired the table.
She's always very observant and appreciative.
Oh, wonderful.
A little poignant part, there was a table that young Elmo had bought for the patio, one of these little circular tables.
Had a
three
umbrella.
Legs and an umbrella hole, unfortunately. And it had gone into rather disrepair, having been out in the weather a lot. And she says, is there anything we can do to Elmo's table? And you can just tell, you know, that was one of the last tangible things around there that reminded her of Elmo. So Max and I got busy and sanded it all down, repainted it, and I put it sheets of plywood and salt so that we could cut out and put a new circular top on it, painted about half a dozen coats on that. Just thrilled her to death. One year before after she got there and we'd done a number of things, she says, wouldn't it be pretty if we had pansies coming from this gate to the front steps, the entrance of Sylvanitis? And I said, Yes, pansies have always been my favorite. She says, someday I'm gonna have a garden and do that. Well, we went out that afternoon and got the pansies while they were out walking and got them in the ground, and she came back and tears came in her eyes. And it's just little things that both of them notice and appreciate just as much as something big. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, there was some work that needed to be done on the house down there, and we had just had at home ceiling fans put in all our bedrooms. We have four bedrooms upstairs. And in doing that, they found the wires were, they've been fried, cooked and baked for ages. That house was built in 1923, mm-hmm. and those wires probably have been there since then. So Emmett was talking to Bud about it. And they walked around the house, and Emmett made a list of the things that needed to be done to keep that house in repair, because it's right downtown, it's wonderful. So he got home and made a list, 14 pages of things.
Yeah, the first year was about 2 or 3 pages, and then 2 years later, remember, just before we got there,
they had the fire.
Their younger daughter, Musetta, and her husband were walking out of the house after having done some painting in it. Just a smoke was coming up from an outside outlet.
From out of the basement?
By the front door. And this was an old lead that had been run through for that, and the smoke was coming up, and they saw it, and quickly, the fire department, just a couple of blocks away, got there quickly, and they said, gee, the house could have really burned if you didn't got out the back door instead of the front door. And with that, then I did a much more thorough inspection of the house and did a list of 14 pages for him.
14.
Resulted in the house getting completely resided, all of the electrical wiring redone, and he's been dutifully these things get accomplished. I don't want to get a green stripe, Chief. I don't need a green stripe.
It's kind of a reverse of the way it used to be.
Right. Yeah, shoes on the other foot now.